know you don't want to be injured all your life, but don't settle that case tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. We're going to get a little political on this episode because we have Mr. Mike Arias, a very special guest here. Came down to San Diego for a conference, and for those of you that don't know Mike Arias, he is president of every leaders forum in the plaintiff organization in the nation. Mike, why don't you say hello?
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
And if our YouTube listeners out there, I mean, look at this badge that Mike Arias is wearing. He's like a 5-star general. There's 20. What is all this, man? What is this?
Just things you get when you're involved in certain parts of the organization. So,
state president.
Yeah.
So we also have on
one of these. One of these I get because I'm old.
The purple one's old.
The purple is for stalwarts. So if you're old, you get that one. Actually, that's if you've been a member of AAJ for longer than 25 years.
I thought you just got black and blue a little more.
That's true. That's true.
We also have Miss Sienna Coyota-Wate. Say hello.
Hello.
And
thank you for having me.
Sienna, you are also on the board of COAC.
I am.
Could you tell the listeners what that is? What that organization is and does.
California Association of Consumer Attorneys, and you know, we're part of the local boards in our organization, but this one covers all the interests of the consumer attorneys, and we go lobby and make sure our consumers are protected. Mike is the president of that, and I've been lucky enough to go up to Justice Day and lobby for those interests as well.
So, Mike, how important is consumer attorneys getting active politically to be able to help things as a whole? I mean, because you do a lot of it. I mean, it's got to be a full-time job for you.
It is. It's one of my jobs. But I think, you know, a lot of people ask me why I do so much of it and why I spend so much time. You guys are great trial lawyers. I consider myself a decent lawyer. We have to have the tools. We have to have the laws. We have to have the ability to advocate for our clients. And the only way you can really do that is if you have the procedures in place and the substantive law in place that allows you to bring justice to your clients. And CAOC is a lot different from CALA, which I know you're both very involved in, because that organization is what really is the safeguard against legislation that's proposed every year by the chamber, by business interests to enact laws that will limit our clients' rights. Not just our clients' rights substantively, but also try to make your and my ability in the courtroom much harder by enacting and trying to change procedures that are hard.
So for our listeners, COAC is the statewide trial organization for us, and CALA, CAALA.org, if you want to go, is the Los Angeles-based consumer advocate trial lawyers. And our national one is AAJ, American Association for Justice.
Correct.
And Mike, have you been president of all of those?
So as you know, I was president of CALA last year. I'm president of CAOC this year. And eventually, I've been asked, when will I do AAJ? And I will eventually. I'm involved. I chair several committees, and I do a lot of things in AAJ already. But I'm glad you raised that, Bob, because I think a lot of people don't understand why all three are so important to their practices. At CALA, you guys are part of an organization that we are probably the best organization for educating, networking, helping our fellow brothers and sisters become great trial lawyers because of all the different educational things we do, the networking, and that's good at the local level. So we help our brethren, our sisters become better trial lawyers. At the state level, that's all where the laws are made. That's where all the procedures that you use and the laws that you use every day in the courtroom are done. And politically and legislatively, can't be done at the local level. Nationally, where you're here in San Diego for AAJ, most lawyers don't realize and appreciate what happens in D.C. that has an ability to affect your practice.
So, and you do a lot of, you know, fundraising to help change things blue, to get things back the way that they are. Are there any things that our listeners can do, you know, contested races or things that you see on a national level? Because we have a national pool that they're listening. Are there some key battlegrounds that we could help out in?
There are. And let me say this. This is not really necessarily from a trial lawyer's perspective a Democratic or Republican issue. It's a civil justice issue. We back and support Republican candidates that are pro-civil justice.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's just a matter of finding the candidates that understand what it means to protect the little guy, to level the playing field, to make sure that people are treated fairly. And that doesn't really, for me personally, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. We have a Republican caucus in AAJ, and we support Republican candidates that are pro-civil justice. But across the nation over this next election cycle, the biggest issue that we all are facing, most people think it's the presidency. And I think that is going to be important because a lot of people just don't want to go through what we've gone through in the last couple of years. But in reality, it's the Senate, because of the impact that the Senate has in who it approves to be federal judges. Now, I know you guys don't spend a lot of time in federal court, but a lot of lawyers do, and the judges that are being appointed to the federal court now are scary. They're literally scary.
I mean, I've seen ones that even, one guy didn't, never took a deposition, one guy didn't know what it was.
Right? Motion limine, they didn't know what that was either.
And we were just talking about that. I was just in a meeting, just now with Senator Durbin, and we were talking about that, and he mentioned that same person. And fortunately, that person withdrew because he realized he was just not qualified. And that is what the Trump administration is now proposing through the Federalist Society, which is an ultra-conservative society that is having all these judges throughout the country being appointed at the district and appellate court level, which is really in reality going to just cripple a lot of the things we've all fought for decades.
Wow. And I mean, can you educate some of our listeners just to take it back? Because some of us get so busy in our practices. And Mike, you said you think you're just a good trial lawyer. You were just awarded Daily Journal Top 30 plaintiff lawyers, right?
Yes, I was.
And I mean, what is the name of your firm, just so people know?
Arias Sanguinetti, Wang and Trios. And we're in Los Angeles, Oakland, Las Vegas, and in Montreal, Canada.
And Sanguinetti, she was also president of a lot of these organizations, was she not?
She was president of CAOC a few years ago, and she's the current president of AAJ right now.
Wow. So what are some things a brick-and-mortar lawyer, a solo practitioner that doesn't have a lot of time, what's best to allocate their time actually to do to help?
That's a great question, Bob. If people don't have the economic resources, but they have some sweat equity that they can invest in it, it's getting out there and helping to educate people. Trial lawyers, we educate juries every time we step into a courtroom. If you can take the time to educate people around you, people that aren't uncertain about certain elections, uncertain about certain issues, become educated in those, become sufficient to talk about this, and start educating people. Because the 2020 election, I think, will be the heaviest turnout election in our country's history on both sides, Republican and Democratic. And my hope is simply, I think people should vote the way they feel, but hopefully those votes and the decisions they make are based on a true understanding of the issues.
The actually being educated on the issue. I think uneducated voting, I mean, it's a problem, but it's up to us to solve that problem, right?
Well, what you've seen and what bothers me is the tribalism you're seeing. It doesn't matter what the issue is. If I'm a Republican and I like Trump, I'm going to vote for him. I've been very appreciative of the Republican friends I know who look at the issues and say, no, I'm going to vote on the issues and what I think is best for our country. And if we get there, which I think is what's made this country so strong, is because our true belief in everything we do. We as trial lawyers are the best examples of people that do not ever want to see people treated unfairly.
Yeah. And so what do you do how do you pick and choose your battles, Mike? Because your leaderships of these organizations, you're out there trying cases, you do a lot of education through CALA, you run the Trial Academy. I mean, are you a clone? Did you ever see that movie Multiplicity? Yeah. Like, is there actually multiple bikes?
You know, I get that asked a lot, and I take it as a compliment. You know, I'm older than you, much older than you, and my kids are grown, and you have young kids. And so I was the same way you were. There was years ago I couldn't do what I do now. Yeah. And when it got to a point where I have a 30-year-old daughter and a 27-year-old son, I don't have to worry about them. I don't have to spend my weekends with them. And I have a very understanding wife, Sarah, who you know, who understands what I do. And she truly supports me because she sees how passionate I'm about it. She sees at this stage in my career, I've been doing this for 35 years. I'm 60 years old. The last couple decades in my career, I really want to spend my time helping younger lawyers get better, making sure they have the tools and resources so that the civil justice system doesn't crumble. It's not going to crumble because I'm not around, but I want to make sure I have at least provided enough people with the tools and the resources to continue to do what we do, because I go to bed every night sleeping like a baby because I know I fight the good fight. And I just want everybody else to do the same
thing. You wear the white
hat? Yeah, we do.
And a white collared shirt today. Looking very sharp. Looking very sharp. So just for our listeners to know, and some of the younger lawyers, they don't know that in the 90s, we were very close to I mean, capping. I mean, it was going to be a disaster, which almost happened on a proposition level. Could you just tell our listeners? Because it shocked me. I had no idea about that way back.
So. Yeah, they were the terrible 200s. There was a series of pieces of legislation that the chamber and corporate interests were trying to do to cripple trial lawyers. They realized that most people, you know, if you're a corporation, you're going to pay your lawyers $1,000 an hour, and you'll pay all you need to pay to defend every issue that you need to defend as a corporation. The normal human being, the citizen that walks the street, the working class person, they don't have that ability, so the main way they get justice is through our system, which allows for contingency fees. And so every lawyer has to make money to be able to support those contingency practices. And so the chamber said, well, how can we get these guys out of here, because they're killing us, because they're winning these trials and they're showing that we're making defective products and we're bad actors, and how do we get them out of there? Well, let's, if we can cut their fees down so they can't make a lot of money, then they'll leave. And there was a big attempt to do that. And fortunately, from a lot of people well before me, a lot of strong men and women of this organization, of CAOC and CALA and all the trial lawyers, we rallied and raised a lot of money. We educated the citizens, we had educated the people to understand what this was about, and that those initiatives, you know,
it
lost.
It was close. I mean, it was like, Jeff Wells tells a story where he went to bed thinking he could no longer practice law anymore, and woke up and it, you know, barely won.
I will tell you, in my long career, it was probably the most fearful time I had in my life is my ability to practice law, because I would not be a good corporate lawyer. I would not be a good defense lawyer, just because my soul is to help the little guy, help those people that have been offended, and there was a lot of us. I don't know if I ever really feared anything else since then. It was that bad.
So could you, in the past, say 12 months, could you give our listeners an idea of, you know, when we make our donations to our political action committees, when we have people like you, boots on the ground out there, what are some bills that really, that we were able to kill, that really could have affected a pathway to justice? And what are some things that are recent or could be in the near future that is going to give us more of an access to justice?
At the national or state level?
Either or.
So it happens every year. This year I've spent more time in Sacramento than I probably wanted to spend going back up to...
Did you stay at the Citizen Hotel? It's so nice.
Citizen. I actually like the Kempton, but because it has a Peloton in the gym.
What is a Peloton?
It's a bike. It's a.
Does it look like a Pelican?
This year I had a very hefty agenda of legislation that I wanted us to push. In fact, if this should be our most successful year, is the number of bills that we think will get passed. Hmm. And a lot of that dealt with extending the statute of limitations for victims of sexual assault, for allowing victims of sexual assault against governmental entities. Instead of having 6 months to bring your case, now with this new bill, they're going to literally have 3 years to which to file the government claim and a whole another year to file after.
That's huge.
And that was big, because most victims of sexual assault, it takes them a while to process it and to get to the point where they want to step up. And so 6 months was just unreasonable.
And Sienna, you did a lot of, you know, sex abuse cases at the DA's office. Is the same thing you saw with the type of people that were just afraid to say or do anything?
Yeah, a lot of times they're just, like, feeling guilty and trying to process it, like you were saying. So it's hard for them to come forward and even do the criminal side of it. I can't imagine the civil, where they're exposed to being deposed, you know, for 7-8 hours and... putting their whole life under subpoena and being exposed to, like, everything that they have out there. So this is a great option. We have a couple cases currently that we're working on against LAUSD, so I know that we were right close to the six-month statute of limitations. So this is great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So there's other types of legislation. I'd love to talk about it, but...
Why don't you talk about the insurance bill that you want to bring up that we're, like, lobbying at Justice Day? They were trying to, like, the minimums...
Oh, well, that's gonna be a project over time, because there's a couple projects that I personally am going to be, in fact, I have meetings tomorrow on it, that there's two big injustices in California that I'm going to work on even after my presidency is over, and I'm putting together teams and that are going to work on these. And one is, of course, to adjust our minimum insurance requirements in California, which are one of the lowest in the country. And we also have stacking, or in other words, where they pile them on top of each other. So if you have a $15,000 UM policy and you get hit by a driver with a $15,000 policy, you get zero because you're offset by that amount. So I'm going to be working on that. There's a lot of us that will be working on that. The other is MICRA. MICRA is something that I'm going to be spending a lot of my quote-unquote free time when I'm done with this putting together. We've already got a judicial approach that we've been working on with some very good lawyers to hopefully get the process maybe resolved through the Supreme Court. And then we're also going to do a legislative approach. But that's going to take a couple of years. It has to be done the right way, and it has to be done in such a way.
And we had the Rowleys on with Jamie Cord a few episodes ago to talk about this issue. And they do believe that with enough consumer push and education and with having the people that we have in office, and he flat out, I mean, Nick went and called out Governor Newsom to get up there and make a change. But do you think now in a political landscape that we have in California that it's finally time to make that change?
So I think the governor can only sign a bill that gets to him.
Yeah.
So we have to get through the Assembly and the Senate, and that is going to take us acquiring the necessary votes in both houses. I believe that there are going to, by the time we get a bill in front of the governor, we get to that point in time, we will have enough fair-minded Assembly members and senators who will understand the inequities of our system. Look, you look at states like Oklahoma, Kansas, their Supreme Courts and their courts have reversed them.
Yeah.
And we are, California, one of the most progressive states in the country, and we still have that. Now, we started it. We gotta own it. California started limits. But I have spent time with the Chief Justice, with the governor, with a lot of people talking about it, and I think if the right bill gets in front of this governor, I think this governor, hopefully, I think my view would sign it. But we got to get there first. And that's a process that takes time. And I just want everybody, I appreciate Nick's efforts. I think that is anytime you educate the people about what it's about, it's always a good thing. So if he's successful, great.
I mean, you have an office in Montreal. And Sienna, what did you just learn about the limits in Canada?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. They were just telling us the minimums are 200,000, and then everyone has uninsured motorists of 1 million at least. So you don't have to go after any like corporations.
Maybe we should change things here, eh?
For sure.
There's good things about Canada you like. There's some of the things you probably wouldn't like. But, you know, it's a whole different judicial system and justice system that we have. Very similar, but their procedures are a lot different.
Yeah, we're going to learn about it tomorrow.
Okay.
So do you speak French? I mean,
No. It's the Canadian office is primarily for class actions that can't, because you can't pro hoc vice in Canada. You have to go through another firm. So, as you know, my firm also does a lot of class action work. So, I was the chair of the class action litigation group here for AAJ. So, I just try to get those cases that we've been able to obtain justice in the U.S. and then get them to our firm Canada, and they can try to do it there.
Wow. Well, we are out of time here today. We want to thank Mike Arias for fitting in his busy schedule. I mean, the guy's out there slaying dragons for us on a multitude. He's like St. George over here, this guy.
So, I appreciate it.
We want to thank Mike for coming on. Anybody that wants to get involved, you can find Mike Arias on the internet. You can also go to CALA.org or CAOC.org or AAJ.org. Help join the fight that's changed it, but it starts with all of us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Any questions, MediaJusticeTeam.com. And Sienna?
No sleep till justice.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I know you don't want to be. I suited up for a trial by fire. I fell.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast, coming to you from sunny San Diego, California. This is the Executive Director edition of the Justice Team Podcast. And that song was by Sevi Fisher, Trial by Fire. Always a pleasant pleasant to hear, Johnny. So we have a couple, you know, you guys are executive directors, and you're also married to each other, right?
Yep.
So first, we have Stuart Zanville. And could you introduce your bride?
I can. And that's Lisa Zanville, executive director of the L.A. Trial Lawyers Charities. Yep.
And could you introduce your groom?
My husband of 39 years.
Wow. Woo-hoo!
Is Stuart Zanville, the executive director of CALA.
So, first question is to Stuart, what does an executive director do of the largest plaintiff bar organization in the country?
Executive director of the world's largest local plaintiff bar association stays out of the way and allows their 3,000 members to do what they do to protect people.
All right. And how long have you been in that role?
In that role, I joined CALA 15 years ago in 2004, and I became executive director in 2006.
So what did you do before being executive director of the largest and most powerful local plaintiff bar organization in the country?
That is a leading question. Not relevant.
But I didn't hear Tom Fair object. Tom?
I have no objection.
Thank you. Proceed.
I had a varied career in sports and entertainment, none of which has anything to do with what I do now, and all of which has everything to do with what I do now.
So we're going to turn to your wife here. Tell our listeners who are not familiar with Child Lawyers Charities, Los Angeles Child Lawyers Charities, what is it? What does it do?
We're a nonprofit organization made up of primarily plaintiff attorneys, and we focus on five areas: helping in children, education, persons with disabilities, survivors of abuse, and homelessness. And we do this by providing grants every year to about 93 partner charities. In addition, and the thing that I'm most proud of, is that we do volunteer work. So every month there is a service project that we do with bringing in anybody who wants to volunteer, but primarily it's plaintiff attorneys, their families, vendors, people who want to help give back to the community.
And that's helpful for those younger lawyers who don't necessarily have the money to give, but they have the time. Right?
They have the time. And what we try to do is create these sort of turnkey type events. So all you have to do is show up. So for example, a few weeks ago, we painted the classrooms at the Exceptional Children's Foundation, or we are gardening at Vista Del Mar and planting a vegetable garden there. But we also have two special events that we create ourselves. One is coming up August 10th, which is our Great Trike Giveaway, which is incredible. And if you haven't signed up for it, be sure to sign up. We raise money to buy retrofitted bicycles for special needs kids. So these are kids who can't ride what we would consider an ordinary or normal bicycle, and they're customized.
If one of our listeners wants to get information or contact LATLC, what's the best way to do it?
It's the best way is to go to our website, which is latlc.org, or to call our office at 844-44-LATLC.
And it's a 501c3.
501c3, so it's tax deductible to donate to us, and it's just a great organization.
And, Vista Del Mar, so we adopted our daughter through Vista Del Mar, who I met through working with your charity. So, I mean, there's a lot of cool little things that, you know, little bonuses for doing stuff with the charity. And Mr. Tom Fair, he's on the board.
He's on our board.
That's sort of what attracted me to LATLC. Is the first time I got to do anything was we were at a women's shelter in downtown, and we prepared a meal for them. And just that love and that care that all of these lawyers, I mean, because it's all trial lawyers, plaintiffs' trial lawyers, and you could see, I mean, the reason I got into this line of work was because, you know, helping people and bonding with them and being a voice for them. And here I have an opportunity not only to do what I love so much, helping people in the court, but also in the community. So it's been an amazing experience. I mean, I even think last year I got to dress up as Clifford the Red Dog, the big red dog.
I was Santa one year, too. It was fun.
We have Santa. We also have a mascot who's Lovey, which is the heart that's in the middle of our logo. And we've had some pretty big attorneys playing Lovey.
Figuratively and physically, yes. We're going to change over here to Mr. Zanville. For people who don't know Stuart Zanville, he is the lifeblood of CALA, and I like to call him the TMZ of the trial lawyer organization. So, Stuart, I mean, give us some knowledge, drop some knowledge on us. Like, what are we looking forward to coming up? Where is the future of law going? You're on the pulse of this. Come on.
I think I'm sitting next to the future of law right now in you, and I congratulate you.
Thank you.
On everything that you're doing to recognize that change is good. And change is inevitable. And if we don't, as they say, adapt, we will die.
Adapt or die.
So I think that the future is bright. And trial lawyers are a unique group of people. And the CALA is the...
We have a unique ecosystem.
They do. But
ego or eco?
Ego. Ego system.
You stole my line, Tom.
I would say that our organization, which we're very fortunate right now, we're up to about 3,100 attorney members. And we are a local association, so we're L.A. only. But we are larger than all of the state trial lawyer associations, except for a small group. So we're a significant number.
Well, let me ask you, where have you noticed a change in the membership as far as practice group or age? Like, has that been changing over the past few years?
I'm glad you asked.
I don't even have cue cards. We're just spitballing. Come on.
I can tell
it's
you.
It's like we mind melted.
That as of today.
I've been watching Stranger Things, so I'm just like.
Uh-oh. Or Below Decks, right?
Big fan.
I can tell you that as of today, 42% of CALA's membership have been in practice 10 years or less.
Wow. 10 years or less, 42%.
And 24% have been in practice 5 years or less. So when people talk about, oh, you got to get younger, you've got to recognize the young attorneys, we do not spend a lot of time thinking about it. We just do it.
And I think
people like you, people like Tom, people like Sienna.
It's changing now. You shouldn't have to wait 10 years to try a case or 10 years to take a deposition or to be your own brand, your own firm. I mean, we see it now in CALA. These people are starting their own companies, their own brand, doing things their own way right out of law school or within 5 years.
And they're impatient. They don't want to be tied to the traditional ways of doing their business. But they also recognize that they have a remarkable resource in the 3,100 attorneys who are also members. And I was not involved in legal associations before. I was the head of public relations for the L.A. Lakers.
The L.A. what?
Yeah,
a long time ago. Bob, you can't be doing that. I mean,
I thought that was like the Milwaukee Lakers.
Different topic.
Orlando Lakes? I love their butter.
When I joined and when I became aware that CALA is different from any other association because CALA allows its members to reach out to each other, and they become a very valuable resource to them. So the young attorneys know that they can turn to the attorneys who have been there before. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, it all started a long time ago. The challenges are the same. The technology changes, but the issues of protecting people from unsafe medicine, unsafe products, and unfair business practices, it's been the same forever.
And we can level the playing fields with organizations like CALA. We can give back with organizations like LATLC. This is a short segment, so I want to thank our two special guests. We literally pulled them off the streets. I got so excited to see them. Every time I see you two, I get such a big smile on my face. But more information, www.latlc.org and www.caala.org. You can also call Mr. Zanville anytime at any hour, and he'd be sure to give you the gossip of any trial lawyer that's going down with a price. You will owe him something.
And if you're not a member of either of those organizations, please check it out and become a member because these are great organizations to be a part of.
Yep, everybody giving back. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming on, our two special guests. And remember, Tom, what?
No sleep till justice.
Thank you.
Law is a burning thing.
Welcome to another episode of the Justice Team Podcast. We're coming from San Diego in the Justice Team Airstream, I like to call it. It's our mobile podcast unit. We have Evan Garcia to my left. Say hi, Evan.
Hi, Evan.
We have Murat Abehan to my far right. Say hi, Murat.
Hi, Murat.
And our guest for this episode is Michael Cohen. Say hi, Michael.
Hi. How you doing? I'm going to break the chain and not just say hi,
there
Michael.
You go. There you go.
And it's Cowan.
Cowan.
Cowan. Like Cowan. Cowan. Like the barman.
Cowan, gotcha.
Move, you know.
Cowan, gotcha. So
Michael, you have your own podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're usually on the other end of this, right?
It's kind of odd being interviewed instead of asking the questions.
So you have a little empathy towards us, right? We're not going to grill you too hard. You do a lot of trucking accidents. We're probably going to talk a lot about that area of your practice. You've wrote a couple of books, right?
Yeah, I'm working on another one right now.
And what are we allowed to know what that is?
Yeah,
is
I'm working on a secret? No, I'm working on a trucking book. It's been a labor of love for a couple of years trying to find the time to finish it.
Where and tell our viewers where you're based out of and your firm and everything.
I'm based out of San Antonio, Texas. I've got an 8-lawyer firm, Cowan Rodriguez Peacock. We do cases mainly in Texas, but for the right case, we go anywhere. So we've been everywhere this year, from North Carolina to Florida to California and everywhere in between.
And we got a fellow Texan to my left.
Oh, really?
Evan.
All right. Yeah, from outside of Houston. Clearly.
Okay. I'm from Brownsville originally, way down south.
Yeah, and born in Brownsville.
Nice. Really?
So, yep. My dad's from Brownsville.
There you go.
So, I'm like ninth generation from Brownsville.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, you know, what blows my mind, and just a little side note here, is just the growth that Brownsville's seen. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it was like 30,000 people when I was a kid, now it's 200.
Wow.
Cool. So, UT, Longhorns?
Absolutely not. No, I'm a Texas Aggie.
I went to
trade school in Austin.
We're going to have to end the podcast.
Yeah, I got to go.
So, and we got a Notre Dame fan over here.
Absolutely,
so.
Go Irish.
Poor guy.
And I'm a Pitt fan, so I have no relevancy whatsoever. Not since the 70s, and so for me, zero relevancy. So, yeah, you do a lot of trials, a lot of trucking cases. So, you know, give us... You know, Evan's working on a big trucking accident case right now. Can you give us sort of what you look at on sign up? How you take a case from inception all the way to trial? What are some things that maybe people who don't do a lot of trucking that, you know, do one or two every once in a while, some big themes and areas that you need to focus on when you're working that case up?
Absolutely. And if you don't start from the beginning, you're not going to get there at the end. So what we're looking for at the end is, how do we make this case a systems failure? How is this something that's not just an isolated accident, but the inevitable result of unsafe choices made by a company? And so the whole time we're trying to go back, and we do what's called a root cause analysis. They call it the five whys. Toyota came up with it a long time ago, but basically, why did this happen? You keep going why and why. So for example, rear end collision, you think it's a simple no-brainer. Well, it's a no-brainer as to the driver. How do you get the company responsible? So
right.
Why did the truck driver rear-end my client? Well, one example, maybe he was falling too close. Why was he falling too close? Because he didn't know what the proper following distance was. Why didn't he know the proper following distance? Well, at some point, it's because someone didn't put him behind the wheel without making sure he knew what the proper following distance was. Why would they do that? Because they don't want to spend the money. We got Congressman Cartwright right there.
Oh, wow.
How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
You're a podcast hero. You are.
So, you know, you said rear end accident. It's important to get the company on the hook. If you already have, you know, an admitted liability, why is it so important to have the company a system failure as opposed to the driver, you know, just isolated incident?
Well, a couple reasons. One, because you want to get, you want to motivate the jury to do something. Right. And so if it's just about one isolated incident, why should they care? If it's about a continuing danger that frankly could endanger them and their family, endanger other people, then they have a reason to protect themselves and the community through their verdict. That's one reason. The other is, in a lot of jurisdictions, if they either stipulate to liability or sometimes even course and scope, they can prevent any evidence of what the company did wrong.
Right.
But in a lot of jurisdictions, if you have, we call it gross negligence. I forgot your term in California.
Yeah, it's gross negligence.
That lets you get it in. And so when you get deliberate, unsafe choices by the trucking company, it lets you get that. And I let you get in all kinds of great evidence that wouldn't otherwise come in: prior crashes, bad driving records, all kinds of stuff that make the jury realize the truth. Other thing we found is that you and I, having gone to law school, think, okay, pain and suffering, mental anguish, those are compensatory damages.
Right.
Many jurors don't feel that way. Many jurors feel that compensatory damages are your medical bills, your lost wages, and unless they feel that it's fair, if someone has to deserve to pay to give anything more. And so you almost are held to like a punitive standard where if you don't show knowing bad conduct, they don't want to give follow the law and give full and fair justice.
You brought up a good point, because in California, I know this is the case. If somebody admits course and scope, vicarious liability, there's a case, I think it's called the Diaz case in California. You can't then bring in evidence of any negligence on the company, because at that point, they are the employee. It doesn't matter. If they're negligent, the company's right. negligent. But right. there is in California, you can bring it in as... And some judges aren't as lenient as others, but you can show that, hey, this is, they have written policies for the company that they didn't adhere to, which goes even, because they have more training than the average driver, and right. the company has policies that say, this is dangerous because XYZ. So they, not only did they fail to live up to the common person standard, but they failed to live up to their own company standards that they require to have you on the road.
Yeah.
And it sounds like in a lot of jurisdictions they have that similar type of law where if they admit vicarious liability, there's still ways to make that useful.
Right, and I think something that you said that was very interesting as well is alleging gross negligence. So can you talk about that? I mean, when, you know, what kind of facts, and I guess it's going to definitely depend on the jurisdiction, but, you know, what are you looking for to allege to get over that hurdle to make sure all this good evidence comes in?
Yeah, well, it starts with a jury charge. So you have to figure out what do you need to prove. A lot of states, it's pretty common. It's something that's really dangerous. You know it's a risk, and you don't care. I mean, you boil it down, you look right. at the jury charge. So we look at, okay, driving a truck, that's pretty dangerous. 80,000 pounds, harder to stop, harder to maneuver, lots of blind spots. And then you just go more and more about knowledge of danger, knowledge, you know,
right.
Especially if do they have prior crashes? Does this driver have a bad record? Did they do any training whatsoever? And then you just try to build. And that's why we start with a jury charge before we even file the lawsuit.
Definitely.
And
definitely.
Then we go back and we kind of game it out. So we break it up into what we call immediate causes, which is what are the possible reasons they hit my client? So it could have been following too close. It could have been distraction. It could have been fatigue. And then we do a root cause analysis for everyone. We can't just rule out on what information we have at the get-go. Mm-hmm. And then we come up with our plan for how do we get to gross, what discovery do we need to try to get this, what other outside investigation do we need to do to try to get this.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of work, but honestly, since we moved from the more of the volume practice to doing this, you know, our income per lawyer has just skyrocketed.
Right.
Because we're just doing a lot better on the cases.
I have a non sequitur. Marat asked me this question the other day. You know, you drive in California, you're on the highways a lot. What you notice something about hubcaps on semis?
Yeah, those kind of spikes that stick out of the tires on the sides.
Yeah, is that just a look? I think you looked it up.
I looked it up. Apparently, it's just a styling thing.
Yeah. So that and Playboy
the
mud flaps
or?
And. You ever see, yeah, the lug nuts, they're just...
Yeah,
I thought they were spikes.
I thought there was a purpose behind them.
Yeah, I thought it was a defensive thing, like, stay away, but it's just the lug.
I always thought it was like a road warrior type thing, you know?
Do you ever have a case with lug nuts tearing tires or holes in the side of cars? And that's something Marat notices on the freeway.
Yeah.
Stay away from trucks.
I've had it where the lug nuts came off, the tire flew off, and that's a real bad thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. I've actually, I've had, well, I guess my dad's a physician, and he had a patient who had a lug nut go through the windshield and actually hit this gentleman in the chest and, you know, caused a severe crash. It was pretty crazy.
Well, absolutely. You know, when things are coming out at 60, 70 miles an hour, you have a vehicle coming the other way at 60, 70 miles an hour. I mean, the one we had where you wouldn't think of it, a tire comes off the trailer, but when it hit this woman's Honda Accord, it's like a knife going through butter. Went right through the roof, took her head right off. It was awful.
Gosh, that's terrible.
You know, and the other interesting thing we do a fair amount of trucking accidents. It's certainly not specialized practice. We do a pretty wide range motor vehicle accidents. But to be a driver I call them death machines. They're massive, massive vehicles. You have to have a very particular sort of training, and you have to go to, you know, the Department of Labor, not Department of Labor, but DMV. You have to have constant physicals to make sure you're in good shape, right? That's
the theory, but it's not that big of a deal. I mean, the truck driving schools, they have a huge driver shortage because the job sucks.
Yeah.
Okay.
My dad was a truck driver for 30 years.
It sucks because the trucking industry has chosen to make it suck because they pay them by the mile. And so all the time that you're waiting to be loaded, waiting to be unloaded, stuck in traffic, having to get the truck fixed. You don't get paid for any of that. And so they have a 14-hour work day, but to make a living, you have to cheat and work more than 14 hours a day. Can you imagine, like, I've worked 14 hours a day as a lawyer, which is honestly a lot easier than being a trucker. We're not loading, we're not unloading, we don't have all that time behind the wheel. And then to have to work more than that and do it day after day after day, it's awful. And so the job sucks so much they have turnover, and you don't make the money you think you're going to make most of the time. And so, you know, the truck driving schools just aren't that great at training. And there's some really good literature out there, even from the DOT, about just because you have a commercial vehicle driver's license, a CDL, that just means that you've got the very, very basic minimal standards.
Right.
You need what's called driver finishing. And a lot of these companies, they don't do it, or they have like a fake program. Like a lot of the big companies, they'll say, oh, we're going to team drive you. You're going to have a driver trainer.
Yeah.
But that driver trainer's asleep in the sleeper cab where you're driving, because he makes money on your hours, on your miles, makes money on his miles. And how are you getting trained when your trainer's asleep?
Right.
And so it's really, same for the physicals. I mean, there's doctors that sign anybody off. It doesn't matter whether you're really good or not.
I know Evan has some questions about the coverage when you're dealing with the actual trailers, hauling capacities. And
yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I guess you can just generally call it finding the coverage. You know, sometimes, you know, and I think this is an interesting area of trucking litigation, and certainly, you know, we've seen it pop up different parts of the country, but it's the idea of, look, you know, there's the motor carrier and there's, you know, could be coverage there, but also, you know, the shipper broker liability. Is that an angle that you're pursuing? I mean, more and more? I mean, can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. It's a way we've really been able to add value, because we'll have a referring lawyer that says has a case, there's a $750 or $1 million policy, but a quadriplegic or two or three people killed, not nearly enough money. Yeah. And so they're like, hey, they've offered us the limits. And I'll say, look, come in. If all I can get are the limits, you can keep them. You know, they've already offered them to you, but let me see if I can find something else. So you have to think of, you get these little bitty, crappy trucking companies, no safety, no maintenance, drivers with bad driving records, and they're hauling. How the hell are these people getting hired to haul goods to Walmart?
Right.
And so you find happens, it's one of two things. It's either a broker, so like, let's say someone's going to sell flowers to Walmart. The flower people say, well, you have to send flowers to Walmarts all over the country. We want you to find the truckers to find the loads for us, and we're going to pay you so much per load. Well, then they have an incentive to find the cheapest people they can get. And so that's some.
You get what you pay for.
That's called a broker liability case, where it's the truck broker, either they were negligent in selecting the motor carrier. They picked someone that, although their license is not, they're not safe. Or sometimes they exert so much control over the driver. There's a big case out of Illinois, where they actually found that they were the agent and vicariously liable for the motor carrier's negligence, because they maintained enough control of the driver.
Interesting.
But now there's even a new thing. Well, let's say like the big companies, Werner, Schneider, they'll say, okay, Walmart, we're going to go and make all your deliveries. Okay? And so we're going to make all your deliveries from this place to this place. And what they do is they will then get more work than they have trucks. And so we're going to take the most profitable routes, and we're going to run them with our drivers. The least profitable routes, we're going to sub them out. We're going to double broker it. Then we're going to, on the least profitable routes, we're still going to keep a piece of it and find someone that would do it at a rate that we can't make money. And those are going to be the most fly by night. And on those cases, we call them hidden motor carrier cases. If you look at the documentation and the definition of broker, a broker statutorily does not include somebody that has the legal ability to take the load and has a contractual obligation to take the load. So they end up, if you do the discovery and take the depositions, you can make them the motor carrier instead of having this little bitty mom and pop company. It's actually Werner or Schneider or one of these, you know, mega multi-million dollar companies. Right. And you go from, you know, $1 million to $200 million in insurance like that.
Perfect. I mean, exactly. And I think that, you know, you said earlier your approach is, look, okay, if we're stuck with the limits, you can keep them, but let me do some digging.
Yeah.
I think that you know, that type of mentality, and people need to do a little bit more digging and keep these people accountable.
And to file your case early, because what I hate is when someone brings me in and you're like, okay, there's all these other people, but limitations is run, so I can't do anything about it.
Oh, yikes. Yikes.
And, you know, you guys at least have all your does in California.
Yeah, you don't have that in...
Oh, we don't have that in most states. And even the does, though, you know, it's not necessarily a guarantee on the dough because you have to have some. If you knew who they were before you filed, they're not a dough. I had that issue in a recent California case. Someone brought me in, and it's like, yeah, you didn't name the right person. You had John Doe's, but you had a letter naming this person on, you know, from the insurance company. You got the name wrong. It's kind of hard.
Wow. So I want to fast forward a little bit to trial phase. You're a trial lawyer podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. So are there specific jurors, for example, when you're doing jury selection, are there certain themes you like to hit or certain types of people you want to avoid or things you want to elicit when you're doing jury selection for these types of cases?
Yeah, well, first of all, the types of people you want to avoid, I think that's really dangerous to make any assumptions that there's any correlation between demographics, political affiliation, race, gender, and whether you're a good juror for a particular case. Because human beings are human beings, and different people that look the same are going to have very different opinions on things. And it's dangerous and actually a bit demeaning to say, well, you know, because so-and-so's in this race, they're going to think like this. Not necessarily. That's a very dangerous. And even if you could say, well, politically, 80% of people think this way, well, that means you have a 20% chance this person doesn't. And so you got to talk to people. And so what I used to do is try to think, who do I not want? And I'm actually kind of doing it differently now. I'm doing a more inclusive, like, who do I want? And so, have you ever heard of Sari Delamotte?
No.
She's a great, she works with lawyers. She's got a book coming out with trial guides later this year. She's really worked with me on who is my ideal juror. So what I look at is, what does someone need to believe to rule for me, to do what I want? What are their beliefs? So, for example, if I have a case where the property damage isn't that bad, they have to believe that you can get hurt even though the property damage doesn't look bad. I need someone to believe that awarding money to people in lawsuits makes the world a better place and it's a good thing to do. If I gave my client advice on what doctor to see, they have to believe that it's nothing wrong with that. And so I'm looking for what my ideal jury believes, and then I'm trying to get questions to elicit who are those people. And as a byproduct, you'll find the people who aren't those people. And I work a lot more on just trying to form a good group. And we had a recent case, my partner Mallory and I tried, very small medical. I mean, it was a broken leg with like 44,000 in meds. We didn't even introduce the bills. And one of the jurors, he was 27-year-old Anglo active duty Marine. I didn't even know they let you be on jury duty when you're active duty, but they did. If you looked him up on social media, hyper conservative. But in talking to him in Fort Dyer, one of our issues we had is our lady lived in Mexico. She was on a bus coming from Mexico to the U.S. to visit family. And after she got hurt, she went back down to Mexico, lived in a little village. She never owned a car, never owned a phone. And I was worried jurors might think, well, you know, $100 here is worth $10,000 there. And there's some truth to that. I mean, money does go a lot further. And so would people award any more or any less? I was worried about less because she lives in Mexico and not in the U.S. And some of the jurors, actually some of the Hispanic jurors, were saying, yes, you'd have to think about the exchange rates and difference in costs of living. And I could see this guy, he was getting agitated. He was getting more and more agitated. And I said, sir, you look like you have something to say. He's like, wait a minute. Are you telling me that if someone from Dubai comes here where it's more expensive, they get hurt, they're worth more than I am? No, sir. This is United States of America. We are all equal. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter who you are. Every human being is equal, and we should all be treated the same. I'm like, I want to hug you.
Yeah. And did he get off for...
No, he kept going? Because they were doing demographics. They thought he's white, military, Republican, young. And I was like, I just made a connection with this guy. He was my foreman. Wow. And he didn't get to do what we wanted. We asked for $2 million, but you need to do $2 million. You need to be a hero to fight for it. And he's like nodding away and... Well, you got $1.25 million, I mean, which for broken leg ain't bad.
Yeah, that's huge.
I mean,
yeah,
especially in Texas.
Yeah.
And but if I had gone by demographics, I would have picked some jurors that weren't so good. And we had a 10-1 verdict. The one was a working class Democrat Hispanic male that went against us. And we had a sheriff's deputy, we had a doctor's office manager, we had an engineer that were all great for us. Because we talk to them as people. We don't.
Yeah, it's a good lesson.
Which is really what all this is supposed to be about, is we're supposed to not look at skin color, religion, gender. We're supposed to be looking at people's people.
Right.
So we're getting close to running out of time here, but one question that we always ask our trial attorneys that we have on here, do you have any superstitions while you're in trial?
I know I do. I just turn them over.
Do you avoid certain colors? I mean,
oh yeah, that's a good.
Do you always eat something? You know, specific. Every
my wife's
day,
laughing. Maybe she could think of something.
I'm not gonna say.
You're not gonna say it? Oh wait. Okay. Never mind.
I love it.
I do have some superstitions. I don't park a nice car in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Smart. Smart.
You're a man. You're an attorney for the people. Right?
Yeah. I don't wear a suit. I don't dress like a lawyer. I mean, I wear a jacket and pants,
slacks,
but I don't
yeah.
wear. I don't wear a suit.
There's certain colors you avoid. You try not to look like the typical slick back hair defense attorney look. The red tie and the
right. And try to avoid the power tie. I do like. Yeah. Like a khaki with a pink tie or something.
Okay,
something off
right.
code.
Good.
Or blue.
Yeah. Blues and grays. We like blues
yeah,
and
we
grays.
She picks
grays.
Them, so she's yeah. like telling me what I actually wear.
Do you wear anything? I know a lot of, my brother does a lot of trials. He tries to wear his worst suit, his most tattered and torn suit for jury selection.
I don't do that. I think there's actually a danger to that because there's, on one hand, you want to be approachable, but you also want to be an authority.
Yeah,
and so there's a real mix of if you're just purely approachable, purely Mr. Nice Guy, then do you have the authority? Are they someone that they have to like you, but they also have to be wanting to be led by you? And you know, if you look too tattered, you don't look like someone that's an authority.
Yeah.
Same for body language, tone of voice. You need to pick parts of your trial. You want to be, you know, like parts of jury selection. You want to get people talking. Okay, so you want to be using gestures where you're going up and. What do you think about that? You know, rising tone of voice.
Yep.
Other times, you want to have sand solid, like, this is a case about a company. This is a case about a trucking company that did not check its driver's logs. That's a horrible example. But
right.
You want to be the authority. And so you need to be someone that they would look up to. So if you look too tattered, you get too cute on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's overall great advice. I mean, there is a balance, obviously. You don't want to... not have a sleeve on your jacket, but
I think there's also sense. On a big case. I mean, you don't want it too slick, but I think there's a feeling like if you're good on your tattered, like you must be. It's supposed to be a shitty case. It's kind of custom. I don't know if I'm allowed.
Yeah, you're
to,
good.
Okay. Yeah,
because
it's like a PG-13. You get it.
Yeah, you got to be a half-ass lawyer.
Yeah, you get a couple
to take this. It must not be a very good case because they couldn't get a good lawyer.
Right.
Yeah. So on one hand, you want to be human and approachable, but you want to look decent too. If not, it does cause other. And also, it distracts them. They're like. They're not hearing anything you say because they're looking at the tattered this or the tattered that.
Right. Well, makes a lot of sense. I think you have any questions for us? And now, turn the tables real quick before we wrap up.
Yeah, this is new. What kind of stuff are you doing? What are you doing with this podcast?
I mean, we've been focusing just on California lawyers. We're based out of California, but we're in San Diego. We have access to... some of the best trial attorneys across the nation. So we've been trying to just find out some of the issues in other states. You know, California, the big issue right now, and it's been ongoing, is the MICRA cap, medical malpractice cap, tort reform. And
you inspired our Texas cap. Thank you.
Well, it's strange because that's, Texas is a conservative state. You would think that makes some sense. But I know there are states like Colorado has a cap and California, which are both progressive states, and they're very non-consumer-friendly legislature, and just interested to find out what other issues are going on in other states. I've heard from Pennsylvania. I heard from Pennsylvania lawyer today that you're not allowed to tell the jury how much money you want to ask for. So you can't say, we're asking for $10 million for this case. You can't
do that in Pennsylvania.
You can't do that in Pennsylvania. And that blew my mind. I mean, I don't know how else you can tell a jury, what this case is worth without really putting something into context and telling them. So that, that seemed pretty wild to me. Any issues that you're coming up with that are specific to the states that you're trying cases in that you'd like to tell?
I just think the example you just gave on California having some bad law, Colorado having caps on everything.
It's
and,
crazy.
That's yeah. And Colorado has the worst, not even gross negligence lets you get in the trucking company's negligence if they stipulate. It's awful. You can't correlate, like I said before, politics, race, gender, with whether they're good or bad for us. So there are Republicans that are good for us. There are Democrats that are horrible for us. And you have to look at legislators. You have to look at people. We can't just support someone just because they're a Democrat if they're going to go in there and screw us.
Yeah.
We have to be open-minded to supporting a Republican who won't for two reasons. One, because those people could help us and their opponent may be worse for us. But two... they're going to be in power sometimes, and if we are their enemies, they're going to go and be vindictive against us. So one thing we've had to learn in Texas is to be a little more bipartisan, and I remind people, I'm not a Republican, but I remind people, the first three rounds of tort reforms in Texas, including when they killed workers' comp, which was the biggest blow to us ever, because that was a huge part of a lot of people's practices, are when the Democrats still controlled the legislature. And the Republicans were horrible to us in 2003, but we have neutralized them since. We have found issues where we have common values. Seventh Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights, and they're very constitutional. We found common language. The energy in the Republican Party is not on the corporate side right now. It's on the populist side right now. We have common cause with a lot of those people, and so we need to make friends where we can make friends and then not let people take us for granted. If they say they're our friends, but then they pass caps, they're not our friends, and so we need to make people earn it.
Yeah, it's easy to say one thing, and then when the insurance lobbyists come knocking, it's a little bit change of tune a lot of times.
That's why you have to make them pay the price at the ballot box.
That's important.
For too long, we've been, you know, when you're just identified with one party, then you get taken for granted, and they do that stuff to you. So we have to fight.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming on. We're getting close to 2:30 here. I know you got
to
run.
Interview.
So thanks a lot for coming on. I know you're a busy man, and give you a plug for your podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation.
Just go to podcast store or any podcast app or triallawyernation.com. Kind of like you guys, we interviews. It's been awesome. I've been able to learn from some of the best trial lawyers in the country, apply it in my own practice, and hopefully it helps you guys too.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Save your tears, little one. Don't forget my friend. You destroyed everything.